This is Kevin Swanson, host of the program, now on sabbatical until late January. But first this. In a meeting yesterday with representatives of the International Association of Penal Law, Pope Francis said, this is the quote, "All Christians and people of goodwill are thus called today to struggle not only for abolition of the death penalty, whether it be legal or illegal, and in all its forms, but also to improve prison conditions. And this, I connect with life imprisonment. Life imprisonment is a hidden death penalty." You know, I wish I could get the Pope a copy of my little book, What Does the Bible Say About That? I wrote it for nine-year-olds. But it's good for everybody. The Bible lays out the sphere jurisdictions for family, church, and state. And these became the bounds of justice and of liberty for all peoples on earth. We call it God's law. Does somebody out there know the Pope where you could slip him a copy of What Does the Bible Say About That? It's a 150-page study guide and workbook for 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. It's good for 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds and 26-year-olds and 64-year-olds and 72-year-olds. What does the Bible say about that? This is a real basic introduction to a biblical worldview. Epistemology, metaphysics, ethics, sociology, anthropology, family, church, and state. What does the Bible say about all of that? Be sure that your family has a couple of copies of this basic guide, especially if your children will grow up and be a part of a family or a church or a country somewhere in the world. And if you know the Pope, get him a copy. What does the Bible say about that? Get it at generationswithvision.com. That's generationswithvision.com.
Exodus 13:3 says, "Remember this day when you came out of Egypt, out of the place of slavery, for the Lord brought you out of here by the strength of his hand." Most Christians accept that claim hook, line, and sinker. We believe it's true, and yet recently, as of the 1950s in terms of comparative history, there has been a growing body of evidence among archaeologists that suggests there is evidence contradicting the early history in the Bible.
I'm Adam McManus, in today for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations with Vision.
My guest by telephone line is Timothy Mahoney. He is the filmmaker of Patterns of Evidence, Exodus, coming out Monday, January 19th in 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time. You can learn more about it at their website, patternsofevidence.com. patternsofevidence.com. At what point were you made aware of this archaeological body of evidence among mainstream modern scholars that contradicted the clear biblical account?
I started interviewing archaeologists and Egyptologists, and what they were telling me was there just wasn't any evidence for this story in Egypt.
So you initially were just documenting what the Bible, the biblical account was archaeologically, and then you were surprised that archaeologists disagreed with one another?
I was meeting more people that actually just said there just isn't any evidence for this, and it was quite a surprise to me. I guess I think they just assumed that it happened and that there's not a lot of challenges to that idea. But when you move into the world of Egyptology and archaeology, there's some real heavy criticism. And it goes back to when exactly did the Exodus happen.
Right. And Israel Finkelstein and Norma Franklin are two of the skeptics out there. Israel says the Exodus did not happen in the way that it's described in the text on the background of the 13th century B.C. And Norma Franklin says, "I don't believe there was a single event that we can call the Exodus archaeologically or historically." Timothy, I think what is unique about your documentary, 2 hours in length, which I just saw this morning, Patterns of Evidence, Exodus, is that you give ample time to both sides of the divide, the modern day, perhaps atheist or agnostic historian, some of whom even claim to have true biblical roots, and yet they deny the biblical account of Exodus, and others on the side of the Bible. You allow the viewer to draw their own conclusion after you examine the what has been described as the patterns of evidence. How surprised were you that these archaeologists, these modern-day historians like Israel Finkelstein and Norma Franklin were so bold about claiming there was no evidence for the Exodus?
Almost all of modern archaeology or in Egyptology today assumes that if an Exodus happened, it happened in the 13th century. at the time of Ramesses, because of the references in the Bible that says that the Israelites built the store cities of Pithom and Ramesses. So everyone has looked at that time in history. When you look there, you don't see the story of the Exodus.
The reason Ramesses was selected, according to one of your experts, was that he kind of makes for a most colorful villain, as it were, especially in light of how dramatic his building program happened to have been, which might have tapped into slave strength.
As people look at this story from the Bible, it's such a huge story. And people from Cecil B. DeMille as filmmakers and a lot of other people looked at him. And since the Bible stated that the Israelites were building his store cities, everyone has assumed that he is the Pharaoh of the Exodus, and he's magnificent. He's one of the greatest builders, pharaohs of all time, and a very powerful. He lived a very long life. I think he lived 80 to 90 years in age. So he had a long reign, and he built magnificent structures throughout Egypt.
One of the things that I frankly was encouraged by in viewing Patterns of Evidence, Timothy, was the animation that visually depicts not only the geography of the time and the movement of the Israelites to Egypt when after Joseph had been sent into slavery by his brothers and then found a place of position because he had become the second most prominent Egyptian after his famine policy was implemented to store up grain during the 7 years of plenty after he had interpreted Pharaoh's dream. Also, the animation that you used depicting the timeline, you had the foundation, which were the non-negotiable markers in history that everyone agrees on, the conservatives and the liberals. Then you had the Egyptian timeline, and then you had the biblical timeline. And it was fascinating to see how you kind of moved back and forth to determine when did the Exodus actually take place, and what does the Bible say about it, and then how does that pair up with Egyptology?
Yes, and what was great about this is we had to come up with a visual. I realized that we had to take complex ideas and make them understandable. And for me, I had to make it so if I could understand it, and generally speaking, if I could understand a concept, then other people would probably be able to understand them. When people were talking about Egypt, there were three kingdoms, you know, Old Kingdom, when the pyramids were built, the Middle Kingdom, and the New Kingdom. And so I thought, well, it'd be really nice if I could just draw that out. And we decided to use a wall of time, is what you're referring to. And we set it in this incredible sort of deserty valley with a mountain behind it. Beautiful setting to basically show timeline of history.
Let's break it down a little bit. Old Kingdom you describe as the time when the great pyramids of stone were built, the Middle Kingdom when they had a high point of art and literature, and finally the New Kingdom with its vast empires that dominated foreign lands. According to the modern day mainstream archaeologists, when did the Exodus presumably happen?
In the New Kingdom, at the time of Ramesses.
And many of your other biblical experts who believe that the timing was off believe that the Exodus actually occurred much earlier, don't they?
Right. And this is where the visuals help, because there are two. There's a biblical time period of the Exodus maybe happening at 1250 B.C. and another one at 1450 B.C. earlier. So there's the biblical time. When do we look for it? And then there's the question of, well, when did it happen in Egypt? Because timelines were created over information that was gathered, and the film even questions Egypt's timeline. So the question is, if there wasn't a pattern of evidence during the time of Ramesses, then where is this pattern of evidence?
And they conclude it's in the Middle Kingdom. Is that right?
It looks as if there's a place. Remember we said Ramesses was the city that, well, underneath that city is an older city called Avaris. That's where the evidence that matches the story of the Exodus started to show up.
We're talking with Timothy Mahoney. He is the film director of a new documentary, Patterns of Evidence, Exodus, that comes out Monday, January 19th, in 650 theaters nationwide at 7 p.m. local time. You can learn a lot more about it and see the trailer at patternsofevidence.com, patternsofevidence.com. I'm Adam McManus. One of the key archaeologists in that town, which you referenced, Avaris, is a man named Manfred Bitek, where he discovered a population of about 25,000 to 30,000 individuals, people who originated from Canaan and who had come as subjects of the Egyptian crown or with the blessing of the Egyptian crown and even given special status. How does he draw all of those conclusions?
What he probably saw in that time period was that these people, they came as a small group, maybe several hundred people. They came in and they started to, without, let's say, there being a war or evidence of some type of battle, that it appears as though they were allowed to come into that area as foreigners, and they grew and multiplied, just as the story of the Exodus has told. Through the archaeology, I'm sure he looked at the surrounding area and saw that maybe it was Egyptian, and then saw this Semitic type of people coming in because of the types of animals that they had.
Interestingly, this man, though, does not draw the connection between the two dots, that this particular Semitic establishment, a 30,000 population in what the Bible describes as the area of Goshen, right along the border of the Mediterranean Sea in northern Egypt, is the settlement of the Israelites that the Bible refers to. Why does he call that a weak affair?
If we look at when those findings date to, you'll see that they're in the Middle Kingdom. And so the question is, are they earlier than should be expected for the story of Joseph? If you have a 1250 Exodus or 1150 or sometime in those periods of time, then they would be 600 or 700 years earlier than what you're supposed to find.
Okay. Your storyteller, an Orthodox rabbi named Manus Friedman, says really the story of Exodus begins before the Israelites leave Egypt. It begins with Abraham when God brings him to the land of Canaan, makes a covenant with him, and in that covenant spells out the entire Exodus. The Lord said to Abraham, "All this land you see I'll give to you and your offspring. Go walk through the length and breadth of this land, for I'm giving it to you." On that day, the Lord made a covenant, a formal promise to Abraham. He said, "To your descendants, I give this land to you." And further, he notes, "Your descendants will be foreigners in a country not their own. They will be enslaved and oppressed, but I will judge the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions and return here." I can't tell you how many times I've read through the Old Testament, Timothy, but I forgot about that passage. I forgot about this prediction long ago in the days of Abraham and the covenant that God foretold the entire Exodus from start to finish.
Yeah, I was involved with it and never thought about it until Steve Law, who's written the book. Steve is a researcher, who's a filmmaker, who came on board 6 or so years ago, and he looked at that text and said, you know, this was foretold. We had filmed, we basically knew we needed to film that scene, and we filmed that in Israel, and it was amazing when you think about this idea that it was foretold.
Yes.
And I think what's fascinating, if you think about that, that means that there was a countdown, I believe, with Abraham's descendants. They knew within a particular period of time something was supposed to happen if they believed in what they heard from their ancestor Abraham.
As you describe it, there are six steps of the biblical sequence, the major events of the Exodus story, running parallel to the Egyptian history. The arrival of Abraham's descendants in Egypt, their tremendous multiplication, their descent into slavery, the judgment of the nation that enslaved them, five, their deliverance and exodus out of Egypt, and finally, in Canaan, their conquest of the Promised Land. And this is where we first hear of the phrase that is your title of the documentary, Timothy, Patterns of Evidence. You say in your voiceover, "We knew science solved problems by looking for patterns of evidence, and a truly scientific approach looks for those patterns no matter where they exist." When we return, we will hear more of those patterns of evidence and what Timothy Mahoney discovered as he produced over 12 years this movie, Patterns of Evidence, Exodus, coming out Monday, January 19th, at 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time. Look at the trailer and learn more at patternsofevidence.com, patternsofevidence.com. I'm Adam McManus, in today for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations with Vision.
The mark of a good father, according to Jesus in Matthew 7:11, is that he knows how to give good gifts to his children. He would not give his child a stone or a serpent. He would give him that which is nutritious and helpful. Now, Christian parents, if you're like me, you are constantly on the search for good gifts for your children. You're probably tired of cheap China junk and expensive toys that break within a month or two. That's why the Generation staff has spent the last 6 months scouring magazines, checking out samples, interviewing Christian parents, and identifying the very best books for our children. We look for creative presentation, substantive messages, biblical integrity, identifiable characters, and riveting stories. We have sponsored a child picture book contest called Nurturing Little Hearts, and we begin to publish the very best of children's books over the next year or two. But find good gifts for your children. That's a really good thing. We have an entire new section of children's book selections at our website for good gifts that you can get for your kids. Find it at generationswithvision.com. That's generationswithvision.com.
Welcome back to Generations with Vision. I'm Adam McManus, and for Kevin Swanson, you can learn more about me at my website, adammcmanus.net, mcmanus.net. Shoot me an email with your feedback to this particular broadcast or even suggestions for topics or guests for future broadcasts, as I'm one of three co-hosts filling in for Kevin through the end of January. My email address, talkradioadam@gmail.com. talkradioadam@gmail.com. My guest is Timothy Mahoney, filmmaker of Patterns of Evidence, Exodus, coming out Monday, January 19th in 650 theaters nationwide at 7 p.m. local time. You can see the trailer and learn more about it at their website, patternsofevidence.com, patternsofevidence.com.
When I first arrived in Egypt, one of the places that I really wanted to get to was this location called Tel Adaba. That's what it's called today. But it's the ancient area where the Israelites were said to have settled. And there's an Egyptologist there, Dr. Manfred Bitek. He's one of the world-renowned Egyptologists from Austria. I found him, and I think I surprised him. He wasn't real happy to see me, but I was able to say, listen, I've been searching for you. I've been calling and sending emails. And finally, I just came to the site. He agreed to let me talk with him. He told me that there was little or no evidence for the early Israelites in this area.
But again, because they were looking in the wrong time period.
Right. I mean, at the time, though, I didn't know that. All I would say to you is that I filmed for another month in Egypt, and his comments struck me and grew in my own heart and mind that maybe these stories that I had heard about growing up were actually not true.
One of my favorite people in the film was David Roll. He's an author, historian, Egyptologist. What did he say about all of this?
Actually, it was David Roll who I can credit to helping me. After I went to Egypt, the headline of this film, it says, you never know where a crisis of faith may lead you. In my particular case, after I went to meet with Manfred Bitek, and I had heard that there was little evidence for this story.
And so how did David Roll play a part?
Well, when I came back, I was actually working on the film, editing it, and I had this moment where actually I had this sense that I've been believing in a lie this whole time. And my family and anyone who believed in these stories were just being tricked. At that moment, I felt like I wasn't supposed to edit anymore, and I had this impression that I should go to my office. And I got up, left the edit room, walked down to the hall to my office, and I looked at this bookshelf, and I saw this book. Someone had given it to me about a year earlier.
A book by David Roll.
By David Roll, yes.
And what was it called?
A Test of Time. And it was published probably 20 years ago on a TV series he did for the BBC. And guess what? In that book, remarkably, was the same dig site. And he talked about what Manfred Bitek had actually uncovered. And he talked about this Avaris.
Okay, well, let's talk about a particular quote of his. He said that there is indeed a reference in the text of Scripture to the city of Ramesses and the building of Ramesses, but it's what we call an anachronism. He said it's something that's been added into the text later by an editor. So what the editor is basically saying is this is the place where the Israelites built the store city, and we know it today as Ramesses, but in ancient times it was called Avaris. Well, this is a light bulb moment for you to hear directly from him, isn't it?
It was incredible. I knew that after I saw what he had found, and there's much more at that location, with the story of Joseph and even the story of Jacob, all the archaeology was pointing to a pattern that was matching the events that happened with the arrival of Joseph.
And one of those archaeological finds was a Syrian house built in the Egyptian culture that obviously came from the country of Syria where these Semites, these Jews, had emigrated from.
Yes, right then, next to that Syrian house, they found an Egyptian palace.
An Egyptian palace that was housing not an Egyptian, but a Semite of some high standing.
That's right. As David looked at the dig report, in the back of this house was tombs. There were graves and there were tombs, but major tombs, there were 12. You know, the sons of Jacob, there were 12 sons, 12 tribes. And in the garden was one specific tomb, which was a pyramid tomb. And only pharaohs and the queens of pharaohs got pyramid tomb. But this tomb was a mortuary chapel, and I believe underneath it was the body, was a statue inside this tomb that was, I think, around 14 feet tall.
So chapel. It's more than twice the size of a man, and there were other things noticeable about it. The tomb statue, the man had red hair, pale yellow skin, which is how Egyptians typically depicted northerners. He had a throw stick across his shoulder, a unique symbol of office, not unlike the assistant to the pharaoh. And on the back of his shoulder, what was seen?
A coat of many colors. Joseph wore a coat of many colors.
You also talked to Professor Charles Ayling, an Egyptologist, mm-hmm. who said that this statue was unique in several regards. He referenced the mushroom hairstyle. Was that unique to Jews over Egyptians?
Yes, and the color of the skin.
Being yellow.
Yes, this was not an Egyptian.
I love the fact that Shimon Peres, the president of Israel, described Joseph as the first Jewish advisor on the earth. I never quite thought about that before.
Yes, he did, and that was an amazing interview.
Tell me about the canal, the waterway, also dubbed the Waterway of Joseph. What did Joseph attempt to do with the Nile?
There is this ancient waterway. And it basically is like a runoff area. What the Egyptians did in this middle kingdom is they dug a canal. And that canal led to a place where it's called the Fayum Basin, like a runoff area. The Nile floods. And when it floods, it brings topsoil, it brings a lot of nutrients from Africa. But if it floods all the time, or if it's flooded too much, then they can't get their crops in because they're underwater. So it has to recede. The story says that the cattle came out of the Nile, remember?
And yes, the dream of Pharaoh.
Yeah, right. He was speculating that the Nile had something to do, because that's where the source of irrigation came from, with the famine. And if there was too much rain in one area, let's say in Africa, and not enough rain in, let's say, Canaan, the whole surrounding area, because that's usually what happens, rain goes somewhere else.
But why would we tie Joseph to the canal that was cut to divert half the water from the Nile into this basin?
Because the time period that these events happened was the time period when this canal, I believe, was dug.
My guest is Timothy Mahoney, filmmaker, Patterns of Evidence, Exodus, the name of the film coming out Monday, January 19th in 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time. The website where you can see the trailer and learn more, patternsofevidence.com. PatternsOfEvidence.com. I'm Adam McManus. You look into the evidence for the rise of one pharaoh and the demise of some of these other people of influence who are very wealthy, very powerful in several districts called nomes throughout the area along the Nile. It would make sense that their demise and the pharaoh's rise of power was coinciding with the 7 years of famine and their ultimate need to buy the wheat from the pharaoh, thanks to Joseph's famine policy of storing it away, selling their animals, ultimately selling their land, and even selling themselves as slaves to the pharaoh just so they can continue eating.
Right. What ended up happening was, during this period of time, I actually went and met with archaeologist Brian Wood, and he was the one who identified this situation that happened in Egypt. Egypt had these areas where there were more like governors that controlled power, but all of that shifted at one particular time, and the governors, their power reduced, all the wealth went to the pharaoh.
Was that another one of those big light bulb moments for you?
As a filmmaker, I was seeking out a lot of different people that I wanted to hear what they had researched. And we interviewed probably close to 60 people in the last 12 years just for the Exodus part of it. A lot of people had pieces of information that complemented other people. There was a co-regency between Sennacherib III and his son, Amenemhat III. And this was the time when these activities were happening with the canal.
One of those two pharaohs is depicted with worry lines in a statue, and his ears turned out. Explain what those two indications lead us to believe.
The pharaoh David Roll had identified was that Amenemhat is depicted with worried lines, and his ears are turned out so that he could listen to the concerns of the people. He's not depicted in this usual bland way where other statues are, or past and future pharaohs. But what he's saying is that when this pharaoh was carved, he was trying to tell the people that, listen, I know that we're having problems here. I listen to you, and I'm a part of this pain.
And what I think struck me even more so was the fact that his pyramid was built right next to the waterway of Joseph, which to me indicated his willingness and interest in honoring Joseph and that he knew Joseph.
Right, right.
I want to get to the pyramid tomb of Joseph. It was found empty, surprisingly. To what does David Roll attribute the emptiness of Joseph's tomb?
What's interesting is that this tomb was broken into twice. According to the scripture, Joseph, on his deathbed, asked his family. He remembered. Remember, this passage says that Abraham said that they're going to return to this land. And Joseph remembered that. And he said, I want you to bring my bones with you. There are grave robbers, but grave robbers don't take bones. So
they have no value, the bones themselves. What has value is what's buried alongside the body, perhaps some valuables.
Right. So when Manfred Bitek uncovered this, he found out that this tomb had been broken into twice. And what Roll is suggesting is the first time it was broken into was when, according to the story, his relatives took his bones. The second time was when robbers came. If they saw any connection, the statue and other things were defamed. If there was an anger, you know, after the Exodus, they went in for grave robbing, and then they took that statue, and it was broke, and they found the remains of it.
One of the people you interviewed, Timothy, is Dr. Hoffmeyer, who points to the burials of the Semites, of the Jews, who were demonstrably Jewish because of what was buried with them, pottery, the kinds of weapons, even donkeys. Talk about that.
According to their tradition, they packed things in their graves for the future. And
the afterlife.
The way that they knew that they were not Egyptian was that Egyptians, I think, were buried similar to a mummy. Their arms were crossed. They were laid out straight. The Semitic type of burial was in a more of a fetal position. They were buried in a different way.
And the weapons were demonstrably different as well. They did not have Egyptian-type daggers, for example.
Yes, right. And what's fascinating is that those weapons, if there is a connection, could those have been from the sons of Jacob? It's pretty amazing.
David Roll points to a time that the Jews in Egypt enjoyed obvious prosperity, according to the archaeological evidence, and then it was followed by a lack of prosperity and a shortage of life. He even points to something called Harris lines in the bones, indicating a shortage of food and nutrients. To what does he attribute the shortage of food and the lifespan that had been cut short at about 32 years of age?
In his mind, what he's saying is that these people fell into slavery. They were malnourished, their lifespan shortened, and that they no longer were living in the same opportunities that they had earlier. And so he believes this is evidence of the enslavement of the Israelite people in Egypt at that time.
One final point I'd like to get in here during our first of two conversations, Timothy Mahoney, my guest, of Patterns of Evidence, Exodus, that'll be out Monday, January 19th, in 650 theaters nationwide at 7 p.m. local time, is the evidence of the murder of thousands of Jewish baby boys thrown into the Nile River, as the Bible describes. What is the evidence?
What they said was, at this particular site, the cemetery had a very high infant mortality rate. What they found was that the rate was significantly higher than in other areas of the ancient world.
Typically, it's about 25% of burials were the infants. But in this particular area, what was the percentage of the burials of infants, by contrast?
I think it was 50%.
Double.
It was a high rate.
So then there was a kind of a speculation on your part that perhaps it was some kind of epidemic. Maybe there was a disease and all these infants died prematurely, male and female. But when they looked at the archaeologists at those who were buried as adults, what was the ratio of females to males?
There was a higher percentage of females. I think it was 60% females to 40% males.
Incredible.
There was a spike in the female list, and there were less males.
So again, evidence that what Pharaoh had called for and what his verdict was to throw Jewish boys into the Nile River because of the threat that he thought the Jews were becoming is borne out with the evidence.
Yes. What are the patterns of evidence that match the story, and what are you seeing in the archaeology? Is that story coming forth? Even during that time, there's a slave list with Semitic names.
The Egyptian papyrus.
Yes, Brooklyn Papyrus.
What do they document there? About 150 slaves in one particular household?
Yes, I think there's nearly 100 slave names from a single estate in southern Egypt. It shows that they were Israelites. They had names that actually are the same type of name in the Bible. Asher, Issachar, Menachem, Shifra. And I think Shifra, the names of one of the midwives.
Issachar and Asher are names of two of the tribes of Israel.
There's different names that were connecting to that story happening, in the Middle Kingdom.
I love what David Roll says in your movie, Patterns of Evidence, Exodus. He said, this is real evidence for the time when the Israelites were in Egypt as slaves. It's when you get a text, suddenly you've got history. Archaeology you have to interpret, but when you have a text, this is something very different and something very powerful, isn't it, Timothy?
It really is. I mean, as we started to work on this, we got more and more excited about how well the story was fitting.
My guest has been Timothy Mahoney. He is the filmmaker behind Patterns of Evidence, Exodus. It comes out Monday, January 19th, in 650 theaters nationwide at 7 p.m. local time. Check out the trailer. Learn more about it at patternsofevidence.com. Patternsofevidence.com. I'm Adam McManus. Watch this very website for part two of my conversation with Timothy Mahoney about the second half of his incredibly moving documentary, 2 hours in length, Patterns of Evidence, Exodus. I'm Adam McManus for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations with Vision Radio. You can learn more about me at my website, adammcmanus.net, MCMANUS.net. Send me an email with your reaction to this particular podcast, talkradioadam@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. talkradioadam@gmail.com.